The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome to another episode of Quite a Good Sport, the show where I, Anna Tyshynski, and this chap, hello.
Oh, sorry, that was my cue, was it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. do you have a name?
Yes, I'm James Harkin.
Hi, James Harkin, great to meet you. This is where I and James Harkin talk to you about sports, big and small, sports you'll know lots about, sports you'll know nothing about, and reveal to you the most interesting things about them, guaranteed to titillate you, regardless of whether you think you love sports or whether you think you hate sports. So what are we talking about today, James?
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you to the Sunday Times for giving us a review which said that we had good chemistry together, and to apologise to anyone who listened to that first 2 minutes of the podcast.
What are you talking about? I said the word titillate and I saw you visibly shudder.
I did. We are talking today about the sport of sport climbing. It's a sport that's got the word sport in its title.
Yeah, it just needs to really announce itself, doesn't it?
So it's a sport which is quite new to the Olympics. It's only the second time it's been in there. And there are various different ways of doing it. There's bouldering, there's lead climbing, and there is speed climbing. Bouldering is you're trying to get to the top of a relatively small climb as quickly as possible, and you have to work out your route and stuff like that. And then lead climbing is more of an endurance thing. And then speed climbing, which we're going to do at the end of this episode, is basically who can scramble like Spider-Man to the top of a 15-foot wall as quickly as possible.
Yes, and I found them all so enjoyable to watch at the Olympics, although I really understood what we were told when we visited Harrow Wall Climbing Centre, which is that your climbing purists look down a little bit on the speed climbing because it is just running vertically, isn't it? You know, they've done that course a million times before, whereas you watch the bouldering and you think, this is so hard. I would urge people to watch bouldering in the starting stages of the Olympics, where quite a lot of people just look at this wall and just can't even begin. It is so difficult, but really fun to watch.
It is. I get that. But also, I think dismissing the speed climbing as just running vertically is quite the claim, isn't it? Oh, they're just running vertically, as if it's something we all do every day.
Anyone can do that. Anyone can do it. But it is really interesting how much of a recent sport it is. It really only became a sport in the 80s, as in a mainstream, widely accepted sport. This is the idea of climbing inside on climbing walls. There'd been the odd climbing wall in Britain and a couple in America before that, but they were really just for training to climb outside. And in fact, I came across an article in The Guardian from 1966, which was reporting on a climbing wall at Liverpool University. It was really unusual. I think there were only two or three. But the writer said, one risk about this must not be overlooked. Artificial climbing might become so popular as to draw climbers away from the real crags. With their handicaps of distance, wet and cold, and the occasional loose rock, it may seem improbable, but has not skating on artificial ice quite overshadowed the skating on natural ice that was so much enjoyed by Wordsworth?
Okay.
And, you know, in some ways, their predictions have come true.
They have, although it's hard to imagine that it would be better to be in the Olympics if they were getting blown by icy cold winds and falling off because the boulders were all loose and stuff like that. There does need to be some health and safety.
The insurance would be more expensive for the Olympic organisers for sure.
Yeah. Yes. I read that like the first use of sport climbing as a phrase probably came from the 1980s France. Did you read this?
No, really?
Yeah. There were climbers, outdoor climbers called Patrick Berholt and Patrick Edlinger. And they started to drill bolts into rocks. And it became really, really controversial that. And in fact, it's still controversial whether you should do that or not.
Because it's cheating.
I think there's a bit of that. I mean, it's the classic thing of anything that humans get involved with. It's like, we all like this one thing, but I'm going to like it slightly different than you. And now we're going to hate each other. There's a little bit of that going on.
It's the people's front of Judea and the Judean people's front. And it's one of the joys of being a human being, finding reasons to hate each other.
That's true. But they basically thought that it got rid of traditional climbing techniques. It wasn't quite as pure as the way of climbing without the bolts.
That's very interesting that it wasn't seen as pure. I wonder what they would think of the bubbly baby pink and turquoise plastic walls that people shoot up today in the Olympics. I'm not sure they'd be fans. But interestingly, Russians were doing it way, way before Brits, basically turning this shoving a bolt into the rock and climbing up that way form of climbing into a sport rather than just going mountaineering as a hobby. And it all started in the Stolby, which are these amazing rock formations near Krasnoyarsk. And the locals basically invented this new style of climbing there in the middle of nowhere. They've got very poor connections to anywhere else. What is there to do? Invent a new sport of climbing. This is in the 1930s. And the best people were these brothers, Vitaly and Yevgeny Abelakov. And what's just very interesting about them is the reflection of Soviet Russia that their lives give. They at first were brought to Moscow because they really excelled at this sport climbing. They were getting prestigious degrees. And then somewhere along the way, they ended up in prison, basically because under Stalin, anything you did really had to be Russian. You couldn't be importing anything Western. Mm. And suddenly the authorities decided that they were adopting a European approach to climbing. There was a little bit of Western propaganda in the style of climbing they were doing.
What were they? Were they climbing up with a baguette and a...
Yeah, they were baguette in one hand and then just a pint of Old Rosie in the other. Yeah. I'm not really sure because it wasn't even a thing in Europe. So it doesn't seem to have that much foundation. But Yevgeny ended up dying after they both served prison sentences. Yevgeny died, as the Wikipedia page puts it, in obscure circumstances in the 1940s, which you never want to hear when you've died in early Stalinist Russia. But Vitaly went on and he actually invented the first ever cam, which is that tool that climbers insert into a rock. And then if you pull back on it, it opens up. So it roots you into the rock. He invented the first one of those.
Wow.
Which is crucial to climbing.
That's really cool. I think like the first world record holder in the women's sport maybe was Russian. And they were quite good at it to start off with, but obviously not allowed into major competitions these days. And actually, if you look at the best countries, there's a few different countries that do it, but two of the main ones are Poland and Indonesia. And what I find interesting about that is when you look on the results page, they have the little flags and they basically have the same flag, Poland and Indonesia, but it's just flipped upside down.
Oh.
So I have to look at the names to work out who's who most of the time.
Well, you can tell because the Poles climb just straight upwards, but the Indonesians do it upside down, don't they? Feet first.
Yes, they start at the top and they get down a lot quicker that way.
Yeah. They always win, but very badly injured at the end. How interesting.
Yeah, so the men's gold at the Paris Olympics in speed climbing was won by Indonesia's Frederik Leonardo. And that was their first gold in any sport apart from badminton in any Olympics.
Was it?
Yeah. But then 2 hours later, they got a gold in weightlifting. So it's like you wait for a bus and then two come along at once.
Two, and you can't actually board a gold medal to get anywhere you want, really, except to international fame.
No.
Which I suppose is a good destination. Oh, that's really great.
Yeah, the national wall climbing coach, Hendra Basia, reckons that it's inherent in Indonesians to be able to climb up walls. He said they have been blessed with natural agility, people from Indonesia, and that's why they're so good at it.
They've got some new physical bit of evolution has erupted in the Indonesians, which means they can rob houses? What's climbing up walls? What's that useful for? Why has that evolved?
It seems utterly bizarre, and I think it's almost certainly not the case that they have evolved extra agility, and rather that they've had one or two really good people, and these people have kind of helped everyone else around them, and there's more of a culture of doing it, and there isn't much of a culture of doing it in many other countries. But let's just say the agility thing. I mean,
yeah,
it's more romantic.
Yeah, yeah, they've developed this amazing skill. I quite like sports that have some sort of application in the real world, and climbing is one of those. We've discussed various things over the years where it's useful, but one of them is in measuring the world's tallest trees.
Oh.
And the person who measured the world's tallest tree, do you remember this guy? He measured it by climbing to the top of it. He's an ecologist called Steve Sillett, and he just climbs redwood trees to measure them and then drops down at quite a long tape measure, which is a very cool use of your climbing skills.
So we didn't climb any trees, but we did climb some walls. And I think we're about to listen to that. But the person who showed us around was my friend Michelle. And she sent me some more facts, actually. So there is a grading system on the walls that you climb. I think you might remember this. It says V and then a number. So we were climbing V0s because they were the easiest walls you could find.
What?
Certainly at the start.
No, it goes in descending order, doesn't it? I think 10 is the easiest and then 0 the hardest.
That's the Indonesian system you're thinking of.
Damn it.
But did you know that the V in that system stands for vermin?
What?
The reason is because they were invented by a guy called John Sherman, and his nickname was John Vermin Sherman.
That's actually not that nice a nickname for poor old John Sherman.
No, apparently he's a bit of a legend in the climbing world. And he said this about crash mats. He said, "You are pussies for using them, and we were idiots for not inventing them."
Okay. So the old double criticism there.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing Michelle told me is that there's a thing called high gravity days. And a high gravity day is where you just find climbing just way more difficult than normal.
So it's like a day when you've had a massive pizza and 3 pints. Sounds like a high gravity day to me.
It does seem like when you go on climbing forums that a lot of them say, yeah, that's because you had a pizza and 12 pints last night.
yeah.
Another reason might be if you dehydrated or something like that. But in Harrowall, they have like a cardboard dial that you can turn. Like if you're feeling like you're having a high gravity day, you can just turn it to a low gravity setting. And that's supposed to sort of help you get into the right frame of mind and go, okay, the gravity is much lower now, so I can climb much better.
So it's a purely psychological tool. It doesn't actually help flatten out the wall for you.
I'm afraid not.
Okay. I like high gravity day. I think we should broaden that out to use in everyday life. Oh, please don't ask me to do anything. I'm having a high gravity day today. It's most days for me.
And did you feel like you had a high gravity day when we're in Harrowall?
Well, let's listen and find out, shall we, James?
Let's do that right now. So we're here with Michelle, who's going to be showing us how to climb later on. But what do we need to do before we do any of that?
So before we start, we need to get our heart rate up, to get blood flowing around our body and warm us up.
How did you get into climbing then?
So I came to sell a car that I'd had for over 25 years and I loved, and they gave me £50 for it. And I was very upset about that. I wasn't happy, but
I have to say, I'm not that surprised if you've had a car for 25 years that you only got £50, but I'm sorry for your loss.
I sold it and I happened to see on the map there was a bouldering centre next to it, and I was curious. Before going home, I just walked into here and they gave me a little tour around, like you had today, and I was blown away. It was so colourful. I could see people of all ages, all genders. As soon as I tried it, I loved it. I was addicted. It was
really
love at first sight. Yes.
Because you and I know each other from outside of this through doing puzzles every month, right? And I'm amazed, like, this is a proper sport where you have to solve puzzles. And now you do it like you have your own, what, Instagram and YouTube and stuff?
I have my own Instagram and YouTube channel because I really want to show people that climbing isn't just about being strong. There are other sides to it. I am a 5'50" year old female with a fear of falling. it's not what people are expecting to see. And I'm hoping that people hearing you two climb today might actually be inspired to try it and realise it's not as hard as they think.
OK, so we've come to an area with a lot more young people, children, doing the climbing.
It's certainly making me feel slightly more comfortable.
So these are routes. So you get a route of one colour that goes all the way up. We sometimes call these routes problems or blocks. Yeah. And they're called problems because they're like puzzles to solve. How are you going to get from the bottom to the top? The grading here goes from generally V0, which is the easiest, up to V11, which is probably the hardest in the centre. In outdoor climbing, it goes up to V17. So rather than V0, we're going a little bit lower than V0 to the intro.
We're on V-1. Oh, God.
We use something called the triangle to keep us stable on the wall. If you imagine the four points of contact, your two hands and your two feet, you normally have three points on the wall, and either your hand or your foot is reaching for the next hold. If you are in roughly a triangle, then you are stable. With that in mind, that's a lot of information to take in.
Let's forget it all and give it a go. So we're doing this toothpaste one now.
Yes.
Cool. The mint.
Okay, so the interesting thing about this one, Anna, is there's a very slight overhang. You're going to have to go backwards at one stage. Okay, so she's got both her hands on the start, both feet off the floor. Let's go, girls.
Now, on an overhang, the straighter you keep your arms, the easier it's going to be for your body.
Yeah, that feels more comfortable.
Your triangle isn't looking good. I would move your right hand up.
Move my right hand up?
To there.
To this one.
And your left hand could come down against the wall.
Okay, so this is interesting. Now, Anna is using the wall itself to hold on to, which feels very dodgy, but she's managed to do it. She's reached all the way to the top. That was really quite impressive, Anna.
James, I'm going to put you on that one.
Okay.
Because I'm going to get your balance.
This is the hardest one in the entire centre, I think.
When you climb, James, can you please look at your toes and make sure every foot is going on nicely? You can reach from there.
Yeah, he's used his legs to get there.
Yes.
Lovely.
That was great. Brilliant, James.
So I'm here now with Jono, who's the senior duty manager here at Harrow Wall. What can you tell me about Harrow Wall? Is this a place that I can just turn up to and climb?
Absolutely, yeah. Harrow Wall is one of eight climbing centres we run across the capital as London Climbing Centres. It's, as you're finding out today, I hope, an incredibly accessible sport. The doors are open for everybody. And actually, it's a huge part of what we're trying to do in the climbing scene is make sure everyone understands there is something for everybody here to enjoy.
So what kind of people come here to Harrow Wall to climb?
I'm very proud to say we have a huge cross-section of our local community and beyond as well. We have this wonderful scheme that allows us to bring in school groups who might not be able to afford it with the PE budget they have. We have lots of scout visits. I mean, literally over my shoulder right now, we have a group from a drug and alcohol rehabilitation program who earn points through attending parts of the scheme that help them in their journey to recovery.
Amazing.
And then they can spend those points on a really positive thing like going to the cinema or engaging with something healthy like coming to Harrow Wall.
Okay, so what we've just been doing is technically bouldering.
Absolutely, yeah.
What else do you do here?
We are London's largest bouldering centre. It's our main style of setting that we have. And as you know, that's kind of relatively short walls, about 4 metres, climb up and climb back down with the soft pads. And that's what the majority of our space is given over to. However, we also have a large section of what we call auto belays. A belayer is somebody who takes up the rope as you're climbing a larger wall that doesn't have the soft padding. So if you have a slip or fall, they've got a nice tight rope so you don't fall and injure yourself. So that's for the longer climbs that are typically on our walls 7 to 8 metres rather than the 4 metres or so of the bouldering walls. We're going to take a look at an area on the other side, the speed wall. With speed climbing, we will have an identical route set next door to each other, two competitors, 3, 2, 1, go, and it is literally a race to the top.
That sounds exciting.
And I think if you're up for it, we're absolutely going to get you strapped into those harnesses and having a go and seeing how we get on.
Brilliant.
Awesome. Brilliant.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget.
Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
So that was mine and James's first attempt on the climbing walls at Harrow Wall and to imitate the competitors in the Olympics, which, as James said, is a very new sport in the Olympics, climbing, or at least wall climbing. But there was, in the early Olympics, another kind of climbing. It was rope climbing, something which I've always wanted to try, actually. Did you have rope? You know, some schools, I think, had ropes in their gym hall or whatever. Did you ever have that?
Yeah, we had ropes. Like, I know that you were doing fencing and dressage.
Yeah.
But yeah, we just had one rope.
You just had one rope hanging off the edge of a shed, didn't you?
We were basically training for shoplifting.
Okay. I mean, there are logical flaws in that claim anyway, but we should move on to real rope climbing, not James's fictitious childhood rope climbing. And this was a big deal at the early Olympics. In fact, the first Olympics of 1896 featured it. And that one had a much higher rope than any subsequent Olympics. So it was 15 metres high. I think what we climbed was it 7 metres we went?
Yeah, something like that.
And that feels, believe you me, pretty damn high when you were at the top of it. And 15 metres is twice as high as any other rope climbing event in any subsequent Olympics. And the way you did it was you started on the floor sitting down and you had the rope hanging there. There are no knots in it. And you had to pull yourself up, but only using your hands and arms. So no feet and legs allowed. Can't push off the floor.
Really?
Yeah. And get to the top. And then you're judged on speed and style.
Oh, that's good.
Which I would have thought quite hard to do stylishly.
Well, especially as you can't use your legs. Yeah. It feels that they would just be dangling around and flailing in all directions.
But maybe that's where the style comes in, James. If your legs are free from the rope, you can do all sorts with them, can't you?
Oh, that's true. So we don't have rope climbing anymore, but it was in a few Olympics, wasn't it? Mm. I think it was the last time it was in 1934. And the winner there was Raymond Bass, who took 6.7 seconds to climb an 8 meter rope. Mm-hmm. And in the Olympics that's just gone, Ola Miroslav, who won the women's gold for Poland, she climbed 15 metres, so almost double the height, in 6.06 seconds.
Wow.
So she's twice as fast.
Wow. But up a rope, which of course, and not to do down any of the speed climbers at the Olympics, even though I sledged them earlier by saying they're looked down on, but I think harder to climb up a straight rope than up an Olympic wall.
Yeah. I think that's fair.
Both difficult.
The other thing about Raymond Bass is he was the only skipper to survive two missions into the Sea of Japan during World War II.
Was he? Good on him. Did he use his climbing in some cool way?
I don't think so. Although I do think that the rope climbing in the Olympics was a nod to maritime tradition, wasn't it?
Was it? That makes sense.
Because I think there was a lot of sailing events in that first Olympics, yes, or sailing adjacent ones. And of course, where do you climb ropes, really, in any job? It's basically sailors.
Yeah, 100%. Always having to climb up the rigging. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Actually, my favourite things I ever discovered for No Such Thing as a Fish, our rival podcast, is that sometimes instead of using sails, then captains of ships would use actual sailors and they'd all have to climb up the rigging and just spread their arms out and pretend to be a sail.
Well, you know what? That rival podcast knows its things are fish. I do think they make stuff up sometimes.
Yeah, they're full of shit.
I think we should start some beef with ourselves. That's going to get us more listeners, isn't it?
Just one more rope climber who was a bit of a hero was the champion at the 1904 Olympics. And he was a guy called George Iser. He was a German-American competitor And he did amazingly well. He got 6 medals in one day, including 3 gold medals. And his golds were in the parallel bars, the long horse vault. And you didn't have one of those springboards in those days. You just had to jump over that board, whatever you call it. And he won gold in the rope climb. And the extraordinary thing about him was he only had one leg.
What? Well, wait a minute. Well, the thing is with the climbing the rope, we've already ascertained that you don't use your legs in that one. Mm. So actually not having one of your legs could be an advantage.
Yeah.
But it's hard to see where the advantage lies in running and jumping over a vaulting horse. That, I mean, I don't understand that at all.
I think that's the one where he gets the credit. Yeah, that's where we give him some serious props. What a dude. He'd been run over by a train when he was younger, lost his leg, and had a prosthetic and didn't let it hold him back.
Another bit of climbing, which isn't ropes and isn't climbing walls, is Towers of Buns.
Towers of what?
Buns, you know, B-U-N.
Yeah, I thought you said that, but I couldn't really work out what it could mean. Continue.
So this is a festival at the Pak Tai Temple in China, and it's every year on the 8th day of the 4th month of the Chinese calendar. And they get these huge bamboo towers and they cover them in buns, and you have to climb up and grab some buns and eat them. And this was going for decades and decades, but it got cancelled in 1978 after one of the towers collapsed. And so they have kind of changed it now. Instead of just one big tower with everyone climbing up it, there are 3 towers made of bamboo and 3 specialist climbers climb up them. And then they get to the top and they throw the buns down to everyone. But also, from 2007, the buns are made out of plastic.
What?
I know.
Where's the incentive there?
Well, it's just health and safety gone mad, Anna. But the thing is, doesn't that remind you of something? You know, you're climbing up a large fake wall with plastic holds on the side of it. It's basically sport climbing.
Wow. So are we saying that sport climbing is actually, when you look at those holds, they're based on donuts?
I think your gravity is only going to get lower if you just turn up at your climbing center and imagine those holds to be donuts.
If someone put a pile of 10 yum-yums at the very top of a climbing wall, I guarantee I'm getting up that wall twice as fast as I otherwise would.
Yeah.
That is a great connection. Well done. Absolutely love it. There's actually only one more instance of climbing I could find at the Olympics, and that was in 1990. This was the Robot Olympics, which I'm sure you all remember. It was held in Glasgow and they had a climbing event way before we had it for humans. Well done, the robots. And the English competitor was disqualified, sadly, because of inappropriate behaviour in front of the children watching. Because, well, do you know what it did?
Did it turn on them like in Terminator 2 or something and started attacking everyone?
It did not turn on them, but it did try to mount the Russian robot. I don't know if that was in an affectionate way or just to get a bit of a leg up. Either way, it was frowned upon. As I think it is today if you try to mount one of your opponents in the climbing contest.
Absolutely. I can say with complete honesty that tactic never crossed my mind when we were doing our climbing in Harrowwall.
Oh, whatever. You know our chemistry, James.
Okay, I'm going to have one more quiz before we go to our interview today. And that is some lingo, some climbing lingo.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to give you some lingo and you've got to tell me what they mean.
Yeah.
So ape index. What is an ape index?
Well, they have very long arms, ape. So is it how much your arms have stretched between the beginning and the end of a climb?
You're so close.
Am I?
I mean, you're almost there, apart from the fact that what you said is ridiculous. Do you know that image Vitruvian Man by Leonardo da Vinci, where it's like there's a man standing with his legs akimbo and his arms akimbo and there's circles and squares around him, and it shows that your arm span is usually identical to your height?
Yes.
Well, the ape index is actually the difference between your arm span and your height, because not everyone is exactly the same like a Vitruvian man. And if you have longer arms and a shorter body, you're going to be better at some parts of climbing than others.
Oh, wow. I'm going to give myself half points for that. What next?
Chicken wing.
Is it when your arm's flailing around off the wall because it can't find a hold?
No, it's the opposite, actually. It's where you jam your arm into a crack. It's kind of jamming you in place and keeping you from falling.
Nice.
And one more. Mm-hmm. Do you know what a flapper is?
I do, but it has no relation to climbing. So I sense there must be a secondary meaning. Is it a falling off thing? You know, when you fall off and you just flap around on your way down.
You know what? I'm going to give you another half point because this time you said something sensible and it was in the vague direction, but it was still completely wrong.
Oh, God damn it. Okay, this is generous point scoring, but yeah.
A flapper is when a large chunk of your skin is ripped off, usually during a dynamic move in climbing.
Oh, wow. That was a generous half point because I wasn't coming anywhere near that.
Well, you did have some kind of catastrophe in your version, so it felt like you were on the way.
That's true. Wow, so large chunks of skin getting ripped off. I wonder if that would put you off your climb.
Well, you know what? It puts you off your breakfast. And this actually comes up in my chat with Molly Thompson-Smith, who was one of Team GB's climbers at the Paris 2024 Olympics. It's a really fun interview. I hope you enjoy it. Let's listen to that now. Okay, I'm here with Molly Thompson-Smith, who is a climber. Is that right to say, Molly?
Yeah, that's correct.
Let's quickly talk about your journey to get to where you are today. So I read that both of your parents are scared of heights. Is that true?
Completely. Like, they have been climbing once each in their lives, and they are probably the most knowledgeable non-climbers ever. They know everything about climbing, yet they'll refuse to touch the climbing wall.
Do you think they kind of get that fear of climbing when you're up high? Do you think they feel it even though they're not up there?
I think my dad's fine. He loves watching sport. He's like a really sporty man and he loves watching me climb. Mm. But my mum, on the other hand, is just a nervous wreck. At the Olympic qualifier, they were both there, which was really cool. But I think my mum was actually watching the BMX competition whilst I was climbing. So yeah, she doesn't enjoy watching it much.
But your mum is, she plays netball though, I think. Is that right?
She does. Yeah, correct.
So you come from quite a sporty family. And is it right to say that you picked this up almost by chance, the climbing bug?
Yeah, for sure. My parents just happened to live down the road from a pretty big sports centre in London. And my brother and I would just choose a different sport for every birthday party when we were younger. I mean, I even had a handball party, which I think is quite niche. And I've not done it since. Not to say it's not a great sport, but yeah. And this sports centre just happened to have an amazing climbing wall. And when I was seven, I was like, yeah, let's try climbing. It looks fun.
One thing that I wondered is, you would think that there'd be a lot of injuries. And I know you have a big crash mat at the bottom when you do the indoor one, but I've been through your Instagram and seen some pictures on your Instagram that should have come with a trigger warning, I think. Like, you've had a couple of bad injuries, haven't you?
Yeah, definitely. And I still get people like complaining to me about one picture I posted in particular about, I think it was like 8 years ago now, but people still say, like, I remember the day you posted that picture because I was eating my lunch and it just like completely ruined my day. I'm like, I'm so sorry. This was a picture of the inside of my ring finger. I ruptured three pulleys in that one finger and had reconstructive surgery. And I was awake during the surgery as well. It was actually the first of its kind. So, you know, it's pretty cool.
Wow.
Yeah, right. So my finger was just open on the table and the surgeon took a picture of it and I posted it online. And yeah, people were either fascinated by what the inside of your finger looks like or horrified that there was all this blood and tendon and bone.
It is incredible. Like, I've researched for a living for many years and have researched lots of odd things, but very rarely I audibly say, what the fuck? Like, as I turned onto that picture. Oh my good gracious me. I can't believe you got out of it. And also you injured your ankle quite recently as well, right?
Yes, I did. That one was a bit less like cool. I fell off climbing outside and had a double fracture and dislocation. I mean, I guess it's quite cool to see your foot at a right angle. Terrifying and cool at the same time. But yeah, that one was slightly less interesting than the finger.
Yeah, but then you've come back from that and now you've qualified. But I read you said that sometimes once you've had that kind of injury, it can affect you kind of mentally because you don't know whether you can put the amount of stress on your ankle now. Is that right? And how do you get over that?
Yeah, for sure. And I think that, like, on top of just being scared to load it, I was just scared. I was scared of falling, which, you know, as a professional climber, it's not really ideal. I remember actually before the first World Cup that I did, like, back from this injury, I went for a climbing session in the States 2 days before the comp and I just could not make myself fall off. But huh. I think I trusted in the process, in the rehab, in the recovery, and I worked really hard. And I think preparation is what helps people get over fear and do things that they're not sure that they can do. And I prepared as best I could. And so I just had to kind of fall back on that and, yeah, use the people around me to really lift me up and fill me with confidence.
So when we're in Paris, what is your event? Because there's a couple of different events, aren't there, in climbing. What will we see you doing?
So there's three disciplines for climbing that feature in the Olympics. You've got speed climbing, which has its own competition, its own medal set, and that is literally a 15 meter vertical race, and it is wildly impressive. It's the fastest race at the Olympics, so that's pretty cool. That's not what I do, though. You've got the other event, which is boulder and lead, also known as combined. And that's where, yeah, you've got the bouldering, which is kind of more skill-based and quite like parkour above crash pads. And then you've got lead climbing, which is the kind of endurance event where you get some pretty cool falls on a rope.
But the bouldering, what I found really interesting about it is that it's almost like solving a puzzle.
Yeah.
Like, because some people who listen to this might not feel like they're particularly sporty, but might love, you know, solving riddles, solving puzzles, solving escape rooms, that kind of thing. And there seems like there's quite a lot of that to it. Is that right?
Yeah, 100%. It's quite crazy that, like, in climbing, you can have the best climber in the world at a competition on the mats and they might not win because they just can't figure out the problem. They can't solve it or find the method. And it's like, it's really funny being a spectator and being like, just put your hand there. Or like, why can't you see it? And it just goes to show how important that problem solving element and the mental side of climbing is. Like, it just pulls on so many different skill sets, including like a huge part of it being mental.
Yeah, so you've never seen this boulder before, right? All the different handles are there. They're all in different places. The people who have made it have decided, okay, this is probably the best route to go up there. And you've got to just look at it and decide, this is the way I'm going to go.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not sure how many other sports are quite like this. A lot of sports, I guess, are either like games as a team where you're like trying to beat someone directly, or they're like execution sports where you practice a routine. But what's really unique about climbing is that, yeah, we've never ever seen these routes or boulders before. We've never tried them before. They're all completely new to us and we'll never try them again. And I'm still thinking about some routes and climbs that I didn't manage to do like probably 10 years ago or something. So, you know, I'm sure they'll stay with me for the rest of my life.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. And one thing you have in common with Anna, who is my co-presenter of this podcast, is that you like an iPod shuffle. Is that right?
Yeah, I've got a really old school iPod shuffle that's basically, it's like a necklace.
Yeah, and so what's the advantage of that over just, you know, listening to stuff on your phone or whatever?
So you're actually not allowed to take any devices that have Bluetooth or Wi-Fi into isolation. Yeah, for climbing comps, we have, yeah, isolation where you're basically just sat in a tent behind the climbing wall and you're not allowed to see anyone else climb. So you have to figure everything out by yourself. And so, yeah, the iPod shuffle is the perfect music device that doesn't break any of the isolation rules.
One thing that I wondered is, do you have an advantage if you're really tall in climbing?
I'm going to struggle to answer this fairly because I am one of the smallest people on the circuit at 5 foot, almost two. Note, almost. But there's pros and cons. Like, I can get into really bunched positions and put my feet really high, but then sometimes I just can't actually reach between the holds, or a jump is a lot further for me to go. So I think it levels out across the rounds, but that's one of the cool things about climbing is that there's no one shape. You get really tall climbers, you get really short climbers, really muscular climbers, climbers that are more delicate and technical. And so, yeah, it's pretty cool that you can see so much variance.
Just one final thing. So when I read about you, I find that you're quite passionate when it comes to inclusivity in sports. And especially when you're doing better and better, it seems to be a chance to amplify your voice and amplify those messages. But do you feel like it's added pressure on you because you feel like you have to do this rather than just concentrating on getting up that boulder? Or is it something you find so important that really you have to do it?
I definitely feel a little bit of pressure. But like you said, it's so important to me that it's worth it. Like, one of the first things I thought when I qualified for the Olympics was, oh, this is amazing. This gives me like the best platform to really speak out about improving inclusivity and diversity in climbing. And, you know, everyone might not understand climbing because it's still growing and it's quite a niche sport still, but, you know, everyone understands what it takes to become an Olympian and gets the Olympics and watches the Olympics. So it was like, oh, this is amazing. Now I can reach so many more people and hopefully do a lot more to change the current climate of climbing.
Yeah. How can we improve that, do you think? It's just welcoming more people, getting more people into the sport, more role models, perhaps like yourself?
Yeah, I think for me, the main thing is the lack of visibility and representation in the sport. When I started out, I didn't really have any role models within climbing and looked elsewhere, like more to athletics. And it's very, very slowly improving, but that's kind of the main way in which I'm trying to contribute to pushing for change, is by being there, showing up, being visible and representing climbers from mixed backgrounds. And I hope that when I have a bit more time after competitions, I can do a bit more like physical, tangible work and maybe take some people climbing from the city outside and, you know, create some more comfortable, inclusive, safe spaces for those groups who don't look at a climbing wall and go, yeah, that's a place for me.
Yeah, because you, I think you live in Sheffield now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're from London originally.
Yeah, I'm a northern gal now.
Quite right, too.
Yeah, exactly.
But then I also read that in your spare time, you basically like to get out in the peaks and find some places to climb. It's like almost when you're working, you're climbing. And then when you have a bit free time, you still climb, but at least it's outside. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it's so true. And all my friends in like doing other sports professionally are like, oh, what are you going to do in off season? Where are you going to go? I'm like, I'm going to go on a climbing trip. And they're like, do you not climb enough of the time? And I think that's, yeah, it's one of the great things about climbing is that I have the competitions and the training, and the indoor climbing is like my profession. And then I also have like escaping out into nature and traveling to amazing places and climbing outside is the thing that is my mental release and the thing I love to do with my partner and my friends. And yeah, it's just, it's so nice to have both sides of that.
Okay, so one final thing to ask you is that Anna and I will be going to a climbing centre. We will be seeing who is the best at climbing, even though neither of us has ever set foot next to a climbing wall. I'm aware that we will be very limited in what we can do on our first ever try, but we want to encourage other people to go to their local climbing centre. So what big tip can you tell me that I won't tell Anna and it'll give me a chance to beat her in whatever we try?
Okay, a secret tip. Well, I would say don't forget about your legs, okay. Which sounds really strange, but a lot of the time people just try and pull their body up. But, you know, your legs have really big muscles, and the more you can take the weight off of your hands, the easier it'll be to obviously go upwards. So don't forget about your legs. And I'll give you a bonus one as well. Watch other people, because you can learn so much from watching other people climbing around you and copy what they do, unless it's stupid.
And how will I know when it's stupid?
Usually if they end up, like, I don't know, falling on their head or something.
Got it. Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us, Molly. Best of luck in Paris. I'm sure you'll do amazing.
Thank you so much for having me.
So thank you very much to Molly Thompson-Smith, who you might have seen in the Olympics for Team GB. And it was really great to talk to her. She has so much to say about her sport, which she obviously loves. And hopefully she'll be paving the way for lots of Team GB success in the sport in future. And actually, Anna, when we were researching for climbing, I think we found quite a lot of female climbers in history as well.
Yeah, definitely. So we've sort of been talking about climbing as if sport climbing is the only way to climb, but obviously climbing has a very long history. There's this particularly interesting seam of people in the 19th century, when I suppose women were gradually starting to be permitted more independence in some parts of the world and starting to want to do some of the same things as men were doing, that they started climbing mountains. And there were a few. There was this woman, Henriette d'Angeville, who was a French woman, obviously, as you can tell from my flawless accent. And she was officially the first person to climb Mont Blanc. So this is in 1838. And that's pretty impressive anyway. But it's the stuff they were wearing that was amazing, because These are difficult climbs. And, you know, there was some jumping over crevasses and having to like climb up makeshift ladders. And they all wore petticoats or big long dresses. And she was wearing like a boa and a bonnet with a veil, which is not what you see in modern day climbing events.
No, absolutely not. She claimed to be the first woman to go up Mont Blanc, but there was another woman 30 years earlier called Maria Paradis, who was also French, as you might be able to tell from my accent.
I couldn't tell, actually. So it's good you specified.
And the thing was that Henriette Dangevie decided that Maria's didn't really count. The reason being that she got quite near the top, and then the men that were with her decided to just sort of drag her to the top while she'd kind of passed out. So Henriette said, well, if you're not getting up there by your own two legs, then I'm sorry, it doesn't count.
I mean, I can see her argument there.
She said, when I went up Mont Blanc, it had not been ascended by any woman capable of remembering her impressions.
Yeah, I like the, you know, she got dragged up having sort of passed out. You sound like you're her explaining it to her friends in the pub. I got to the top. I sort of passed out halfway. But, you know, mostly I just got to the top. Yeah. They had a bit of beef, didn't they? There was some serious shade being thrown by Henriette. And didn't she threw a party to celebrate the fact that she'd been the first up, and she invited Maria, I think, to the party.
Yeah. Ouch. And I think Maria did turn up, actually. Maria, like, knowing her place, as was the case in French society at the time, said that she was astonished that a real lady could climb it. She said, I'm a peasant woman and I know the countryside.
Oh.
So she was like, I could easily get to the top. Okay, I did get carried up the last bit. Yeah, fine, but let's not talk about that. But I know the mountains. I live in the mountains. It's easy for me to get to the top, but I can't believe this.
You know, hoity-toity kind of.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Screw you, Maria. You didn't even make it. You with your backhanded compliments calling me a weakling. Yeah, I'm posh, but I got there conscious, didn't I? No, look, well done to both of them.
So Dangevie, as you say, wearing this outfit, which you would not certainly think is good for climbing. She also brought a lot of food up with her, including two whole sides of veal, two legs of mutton, 24 roast chickens, 19 bottles of brandy, a barrel of Vin Ordinaire, and 3 pounds of chocolate for each person who went up.
Oh, well, at least you shared it out between the people. Was all the rest for her? Were the 24 chickens, that was all her breakfast?
For herself, and didn't share this, had a blancmange, a flagon of barley water, a flagon of lemonade, and a pot of chicken bouillon.
Ooh, well, fair enough. I reckon I'd probably, I think I have smuggled chocolate bars up mountains when I'm walking with my family before, so.
Have you really?
Yeah, I have actually. There was a famous Mars bar incident in my family that we don't need to go into, but it was pretty tense for a few years after that. Yeah.
You know, that's so interesting because on my honeymoon, we climbed up Ben Nevis. And I gave Paulina, my wife, one of my chocolates or biscuits or whatever it was. And she said that was the moment she realized she'd made a good decision in her marriage. Although you would have thought that she would have come up with that idea before we got married, but
the day after the wedding, she spent the whole day thinking I've made a huge mistake. Thank God for that biscuit. Saved your marriage. There's one other woman who I like, and she's called Annie Smith Peck, and she climbed the Matterhorn in 1850. And I think the Matterhorn is famously one of the most difficult mountains in terms of rock climbing to climb in the world, isn't it? And she did wear trousers, and she was a bit of a feminist, certainly for 1850, which meant that a lot of people hated her, a lot of men hated her. And in fact, they were on a field of crevasses on this walk up the Matterhorn. And I believe the men she was with cut her support rope and abandoned her. And she had to make her way back to camp on her own, which she did. But that's, wow. It's low. It's a low blow, mankind.
Hashtag not all men, just to say.
I blame every single man for cutting poor Annie's support rope. She once hung a Votes for Women banner off a mountain she was climbing, which again, how early was that to be hanging Votes for Women banners up?
That's amazing.
But yeah, those bloody men probably cut it down again, didn't they?
When Henriette Dangevie got to the top of Mont Blanc, the first thing she did was stand on the shoulders of one of her servants so that she could say that she'd been higher than anyone else on the mountain.
I worry that I'd more have her personality than Annie's in those days.
There's lots of reasons people climb Mont Blanc. I read this in a book called Killing Dragons, The Conquest of the Alps by Fergus Fleming. There was a Russian count called Matsyevsky who climbed it in 1818 to improve his poetry skills. John Oljo climbed it because he wanted to see a better reflection of the mountain in a lake.
That's a good reason. Love that.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's romantic. In 1834, Comte Henri de Tilly decided to climb Mont Blanc to cheer himself up after a failed affair. Mm-hmm. And there was a man called Edward Bootle Wilbraham who climbed Mont Blanc because he had been told not to.
Edward Bootle Wilbraham. What a great guy. I would have married you if we'd existed in the same era. What a cracking name. Just as we're talking about the history of climbing, there is a good little history page on the British Mountaineering Council website, and they reference what's accepted as being the first instance of rock climbing, as in, you know, you put a hold into a rock and you rope yourself up. Okay. And it was Alexander the Great. This was 327 BC. So a while back, and he was trying to take this fortress at the top of these like vertical cliffs in what's now Uzbekistan, which was in a kingdom called Sogdia. And up at the top, fairy tale-esque, was actually a princess and her mum, a queen and a princess, and various other people. I know, it sounds like I'm describing Shrek, but I'm not. And the defenders who were defending this fortress just laughed in Alexander the Great's face and said, "You'll never get up here. No one can get up here. You'd need wings to capture it." And so he got 300 of the most experienced rock climbers in his empire, and he offered them cash prizes for who could get up first. And so they all shot up, and they used iron tent pegs that they drove into the snow, into the frozen snow or the rock, and then they attached flaxen lines to them, and they climbed up that way, pegs and lines. And 30 of them died, as happens in any good mountaineering event. But the rest made it to the top. And the Sogdians were so shocked, they surrendered immediately.
That is, what a great story. Well, for you and I, climbing up to the top of the speed climbing wall in Harrow Wall, there was no money or princesses or indeed any Shreks for us to get to at the top of the climb. There was just a red button and the pride of being the quickest. So shall we see which of us won the challenge?
Let's go.
This is essentially a mini version of what we would see in an Olympic speed climbing competition, one of the three disciplines of climbing we do see in the Olympics. As you can see in front of you, we have two identical routes, the same holds on the same bit of wall. They start at the same place and finish at the same place. We have a start button at the bottom and a stop button at the top and a digital readout. It's the simplest form of climbing to understand, in that we go 3, 2, 1, go. The first one to hit the stop button is going to be the winner.
Right.
I think we might do a little best of three. We'll switch you over just like they do in the professional competition, so you can have a go on the other side as well. And then we'll see if a clear winner emerges.
Sorry, how high do they climb in the Olympics?
Full Olympic speed wall is 15 meters and there's a 5-degree overhang. So it's not super, super steep. It's not like a very steep roof, but it's just that a few degrees off vertical.
And they manage that in just a few seconds, don't they?
I think that the current world record for men's is 5 seconds.
Okay.
But we measure success by how much fun we've had. If you've enjoyed yourself,
well, we don't.
You're a winner.
Look, I'm sorry.
So do you have any crucial last-minute tips for how to get to the top of this?
I think once I say 3, 2, 1, go, anything you've been taught by Michelle earlier is probably going to have left your brain, because it's going to be a scramble. Why don't you treat this first run as a bit of an explore? Yes, try and get to the top before the other person. And if you are finding yourself at the top, don't forget your ultimate goal for this particular challenge is hitting that big red button at the top, which is going to stop your timer to the nearest tenth of a second.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe that's massively ambitious. Let's just see what happens. This is kind of the whole point. I'm going to ask you both to get one hand and one foot on the wall. 3, 2, 1, go. Okay, speedy start. These guys are showing absolutely no fear. Anna's definitely halfway up the wall. James, maybe half a meter behind, but there's still plenty of opportunity to claw this back, I think. Looking for that big red button. Excellent, we got a finisher. And we have James on the ground and Anna on the ground.
My time was 30 seconds.
30 seconds on the dot.
And James still seems to be climbing.
James is still going. We didn't quite get to the finish button up there. So I think it's fair to call that 1-0 Anna. Are we agreed?
Did you forget to press the button?
No, I didn't get close. I just slipped. For me, it was like I was trying to do it properly, and then I looked up, and Anna was about 2 meters ahead of me, and I was like, "Uh-oh."
Okay, guys. So, in the interest of absolute fairness, we have switched you over. Now, obviously, it's an identical route, but we just want to trim out any suggestion of unfairness. So it's an absolute win for whoever comes out on top.
Okay.
In 3, 2, 1, go. Absolute neck and neck. James is clearly not happy about being first time round, so he's gone out extremely quickly. It is entirely neck and neck at the moment. I cannot separate them. It's going to be neck and neck. Go for the button. Oh. Yes.
Oh, God damn it.
James, tell us what your score. What was your time?
My time was 17.7.
17.7 seconds. Anna?
My time is 18.2.
18.2. So you've trimmed off almost 12 seconds from your first attempt.
Oh, wow.
I trimmed off an infinite number of seconds.
An infinite amount of time.
I'm absolutely exhausted after that.
But however, we have to do one more because you're tied at 1-1.
We do.
Well, I didn't think that through, did I?
Yeah, you should have just lost it easy.
I think we should just flip over again.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. Because this one's defeated me once and I don't want it to defeat me again.
So, third and final run. Any tactics? Anything you're going to do different?
For me, the best thing was to not think about anything apart from where your next hand's going to go.
Get in the zone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the zone. Okay.
3, 2, 1, go. Blinding start from Anna, straight out the blocks. Loads of time to take it back, James. Can she hang on, not have a slip before hitting that button? There's the button. James, keep going. Can you go? Yes, you can. Fantastic. Okay, James, give us your time.
24.9.
Anna?
15.2.
We have a winner. Congratulations.
Thank God. So, James, how was that for you?
Well, the second one was good, but I can't really remember much about the first one and the third one. What happened?
Oh, let me refresh your memory. I beat you, mate.
Yeah, I know. You did really well. I got to say, you picked it up really well in the bouldering part. And I thought my competitive nature would bring me through at the end. But I just didn't have the skills.
I was quite horrified in number two when I suddenly saw you going past me and thought, what the hell has he done? What? He bailed out on the first one. What's going on? You're too competitive for me, but I am delighted.
I think what we can say to anyone listening to this is if you do have a climbing centre near you, then definitely check it out because it is so much fun.
It really is. It must be good for you getting that weird adrenaline rush, heart rate up in some way, or very bad for you.
We're going to go for good.
Either way, do it.
Okay, well, that was our vertical running race. I gave it my best shot, but I was just beaten by the better climber on the day.
Wasn't good enough, was it, James? Just not good enough at pressing that button?
No.
Yeah, I just pictured a big old donut up there and somehow.
And I look like a big old donut up there, I think. I've got to say, I've seen the videos of us doing this climb and also have watched the Olympic speed climbing. And it looks like a very different sport.
Really? How surprising. It's weird because when I watch the Olympic climbing, I felt I know exactly how that feels.
Yeah.
And you're saying maybe I don't.
It looks from the video that we've only gone up a few metres and that we went up extremely slowly. But actually, when you're doing it, it feels like you're going super fast and it feels like you're super high, right?
Oh, God, yeah. The G-force is almost impossible to withstand. Actually, speaking of G-force, I don't know if we recorded this, but we also went down a wall of death afterwards, which is probably the highlight of my year.
Yeah.
Which is a vertical slide. It was pretty good, wasn't it?
It was pretty good. And basically what happened was we did our challenge and then we had a little bit of time left and we just did all the kids stuff, didn't we?
Yeah.
All the climbing frames and all the tunnels and all the slides and stuff that are really for kids. We just did all that afterwards. And frankly, it made this entire series worthwhile.
We did. Our poor producers saying, I do actually have to do some work. Ask, no, please let me go on the slide again, though.
It was really fun, wasn't it? And I think there are lots of these climbing walls popping up now. And in fact, you know, I've been driving around in the last few days to various places in the UK and it's amazing. You just see them. Now that you know to look out for them, you see these climbing walls everywhere. So there is a really good chance that might be one near you. And I can't recommend enough to go and have a go at it. It's so much fun. I was so sure that I wouldn't even be able to get onto the second hold. But actually, if I can do it, then probably, dear listener, you can do it too.
Yeah, so give it a go now and do tune in next week for our next episode, which is going to be some running jumping.
Yes, I'm 3-2 down in the series And so what we're going to do is we're going to ratchet things up severely and do a multi-discipline event, some kind of heptathlon, pentathlon, decathlon, dodecathlon. We'll have to work out how many sports we can fit in. But yeah, it'll be track and field.
Yes, it will indeed. Unless you want to stop now, James, at 3-2. Very happy. Very happy if you don't want to be beaten even more.
Come on.
Okay, it's a no. I'm getting a no. From the look in your eyes, I'm getting a no. Cool. All right, we'll see you all next week then.
Until then, I've been James Harkin.
I've been Anna Tuschinski.
And you've been listening to Quite a Good Sport. Quite a Good Sport was presented by James Harkin and Anna Tuschinski, with contributions from Michelle Martin, Jonathan Stone and Molly Thompson-Smith. It was produced by Molly Windus and James Harkin. The production team included Alex Bell, Adrian Bradley, Tara Durrell, Ethan Ruperelia, Liang Lee and Natasha McQueen. Thanks go to Harrowall Climbing Centre and Team GB. This has been a quite interesting podcast.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No.